7BR Part Heard.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome back to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Eleanor Day, Chambers Paralegal, and today, to kickstart our fresh batch of 2021 podcasts, I'm joined by Adam Korn to talk about one of his recent cases, which involved an unusual case management direction, which reflects the impact of the ongoing pandemic. Adam is an experienced advocate with a common law practice, specialising in clinical negligence, product liability and personal injury cases, and he's consistently recommended by the Legal 500 and Chambers UK Bar as a leading junior barrister in those principal areas of practice. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Now, you're going to talk a bit about the case of O'Driscoll and Bianchi.
Yeah.
And perhaps you could start by just giving us a brief overview of the case. Of the facts, at least.
It's a claim brought under the Consumer Protection Act. It's a product liability claim brought by a keen sportsman, a cyclist, who was injured when his very expensive road bike, carbon framed, made by Bianchi, collapsed under him while he was taking part in a race, a road race, a closed road race, the Wales Velathon. And all he knew is that he was cycling along 1 minute, and next minute he was in a ditch. In fact, what happened is that the group of cyclists following him stopped. Luckily, one of those cyclists was a consultant anaesthetist and looked after him. He has no recollection of these events, and took him to hospital, where he was diagnosed with various fractures and significantly a closed head injury. And his rehabilitation was very slow after that. He has gone back to work, but he's not his old self. And he's been diagnosed with a type of brain injury called a DAI, which stands for diffuse axonal injury. And he claims damages for his personal injuries and associated losses from the manufacturers, the Italian manufacturers of the bike, Bianchi.
And aside from the interesting facts of the case, I understand that in this case, an unusual case management direction was made, specifically in light of the pandemic.
It was. To my knowledge, it was the first of the COVID directions that was made by any court in this country. It was actually made by Master Davidson in the Queen's Bench Division in London. We came in front of him in the very early days of the lockdown, mid-March 2020. And along with the usual case management directions about expert evidence and the like, we asked him to give us a little bit more time than is provided for under the rules of court, by which the parties can agree to extend time for compliance with any step specified in the directions order from the usual 28 days. And that, I think, is CPR 3.8. to 56 days. And that became known as the COVID direction. It found its way into a new court direction, which was rather snappily titled 51ZA, a practice direction to supplement the rules in part 51. And so it became formalized, and all courts applied the 56-day period as opposed to the 28-day period. And this, as I say, to my knowledge, is the first case that led to the Rules Committee looking at the 28-day period and extending it, because, of course, we're all in a pickle with lockdown. I say we are again all in a pickle with lockdown, but I'll come to that in a minute.
How did that pickle present itself? Was it because it was difficult to get hold of expert witnesses and things like that?
Correct. Lots of medico-legal experts have NHS practices as well and were either completely overwhelmed with their NHS practices or either prohibited by their employers or considered themselves prohibited by what the government was telling us from seeing medico-legal clients. So practically, it wasn't possible, and it is still very difficult. And in some cases, it is still impossible to get claimants, legal claimants, seen by medico-legal experts, whether or not they have busy NHS practices, even if they don't and have retired. the rules being what they are at the moment and what they have been since March of last year, it is practically impossible to do anything other than by Zoom. And of course, in some individual cases, Zoom will do. But in cases where either a physical examination is required as part of the medico-legal assessment, or simply because a great deal of time, as in the case of diffuse axonal injuries, has to be spent trying to get a handle on the particularly subtle behavioural deficits that this type of injury causes, Zoom is impractical. So in a lot of cases, it meant progressing complex personal injury cases where the injuries require a number of experts to be involved. It made it impossible.
Has that case management direction led to similar directions being made in other cases?
Well, as I say, it led to the practice direction, the amendment to the practice direction being implemented. And that lasted, and this is written into the practice direction, until late October 2020, I think the 20th of October or date around then, when formally that practice direction ceased to exist and we all revert to the 28-day period as was previously in force. However, for two reasons, in practice, that hasn't happened. One is that, bearing in mind that the situation the country finds itself in now is just as serious and arguably more serious as when we were facing the first wave of COVID back in March 2020 and throughout most of 2020, judges have said sensibly, in my view, well, things being what they are and experts being so hard to come by, and in some cases solicitors being furloughed again, we're going to continue to apply the 56-day period, even though formally we don't have to do so and we could revert to the 28 days. And only last week I had hearings in front of judges in Birmingham and in London who both applied the 56-day period whilst being aware that formally the amendment to the practice direction had ceased to exist. And secondly, there has been an amendment to the clinical negligence protocol agreed by the Association of Personal Injury Lawyers, APIL, and various other groups, including NHS Resolution, whereby they say that, well, the gist of what they say under extensions of time is that unless circumstances are extraordinary, reasonable extensions of time will not be opposed.
Okay.
And in particular, they've said that, not just because of the difficulties faced by claimant lawyers, in fact, not principally because of the difficulties faced by claimant lawyers, but because of the difficulties faced by NHS Resolution. Because as they say in the preamble to the new ClinNeg protocol, many NHS staff have been redirected to deal with things, although they don't quite put it like this, that are frankly more important than progressing clinical negligence cases.
And moving to a slightly different element of the case, you mentioned earlier about the diffuse axonal injury. Why is that particularly noteworthy and what makes that particularly interesting?
Well, the case is ongoing, so I'll have to be a little bit careful about what I say and deal with things that are only in the public domain. But diffuse axonal injuries, because they are a rather subtle type of injury that can be suffered in innocuous-looking situations, for example, where someone might trip and fall and hit their head on the floor or on another hard surface, or even in a case I had a few years ago, walking into a door. And coupled with the fact that the type of brain damage involved in a DAI does not usually show up on conventional imaging. So if you do a brain CT scan or even an MRI without contrast, you will not see at a cellular level the brain damage. So it's rather similar to whiplash injuries and how they were viewed by the insurance industry perhaps 20 years ago or thereabouts, where everyone under the sun, regardless of the speed of their collision, was claiming damages for whiplash injuries. And insurers became very alarmed about this because, just as in DAIs, in whiplash injuries, you're reliant usually upon the say-so of the claimant as to the severity of the injury and as to their symptoms. And so at the moment, some insurers are still sceptical about DAIs for that reason. They cannot objectively be proved by scanning techniques. Now, the neurologists in this country who are unafraid to diagnose DAIs, and one of them is based in Nottingham and his name is Steve Alder, and he was involved in the leading case in this area called Siegel and Pump, which is a 2014 case decided by Mr. Justice Wilkie. And in that case, the existence of the claimant's DAI was in principle opposed by the defendant. And having heard from, amongst others, Dr. Steve Alder, Mr. Justice Wilkie found as fact in that case, of course not binding in others, because this is not a finding of law but of fact as presented to him, but he found that the concept of microscopic DAI arising where the presently available scanning equipment does not reveal any damage to the white matter was proven. So there was a proven established concept, and he's referring there to a medical concept, not a legal one, of course, of microscopic DAI. So in our case, of Mr. O'Driscoll, just as in all DAI cases, we don't have positive imaging. So we are reliant in our case upon the other neurodisciplines, neuropsychology and neuropsychiatry, to look closely at the deficits of which he complains, to perform a battery of tests to ascertain whether or not he's been injured and how it continues to affect him. So that's a bit of the background in the case law to this type of case, DIA cases.
I suspect I know the answer to this, but can you tell us if in O'Driscoll the defendant is alleging that the claimant doesn't have diffuse axonal injury?
Well, in O'Driscoll, the defendant has thus far, and we have received a defence in this case, and as I said earlier, we have been through the first case management conference in front of Master Davidson. The defendant has admitted liability. That is hardly surprising on the facts of the case, because as I said earlier, poor old Mr. O'Driscoll was simply cycling along, did nothing wrong to cause the accident. He didn't go into a pothole. He didn't hit a tree. He didn't hit another cyclist. His bike simply collapsed under him. And product liability lawyers listening to this will immediately think of two other reported cases, the case of KTM Baker and the case of Ide and the decision of Mr. Justice Gray, which was a very similar case, where the claimant cyclist bicycle simply collapsed under him. I say collapsed, I think in Ide, from memory it was a brake failure, but it matters not. And in such a case, the facts speak for themselves, and such a product, the bicycle in the case of Ide, and in our case of O'Driscoll, and the motorbike in the case of Baker and KTM, were defective. That was argued about in Baker and Ide. It is not being argued about by the defendant in the case of O'Driscoll. So liability, by which I mean breach of the Consumer Protection Act and some losses flowing from that breach, have been admitted. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I can say very little about the extent to which the defendant is going to be arguing, if at all, about the alleged deficits flowing from the accident, because we haven't received any expert evidence from the defendant, and I'd better not speculate.
Right, you are. Thank you very much, Adam.
Thanks very much, Ellie.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of 7BR's Part Heard. For more information and to listen to all of our previous episodes, please visit our website.